Okay, I'm Joe Salerno. So if you wanted to see someone else, you should be in another room. Okay? Joe Salerno, take a look. Okay. And my topic is on profit, loss, and the entrepreneur. I want to start off with a quote from Ludwig von Mises, which reads, "All action is embedded in the flux of time and involves uncertainty. Anything you do involves the possibility that you can make an error, whether it's choosing from a menu, choosing to come here instead of doing something else. You're speculating on the fact that the choice that you make is going to have the highest valued use of your time, let's say in this case. So, as Mises stresses, all actions take time, and they're aimed at the future. Why is it making so much noise? Okay, I'll try to bear with that. Now, let me give you some examples. Let's say that you have a very munificent aunt who gives you $2,000 when you graduate. And there are a number of different alternatives that you can use that $2,000 for, all of which will bring you satisfaction of a greater or lesser degree. So let's say you could do a number of things with the $2,000. You could go on, a Caribbean cruise with your friends. Okay, you graduate from college, so you can go celebrate with your friends, go on a cruise. That will absorb the $2,000. And let's say you rank that first. Or, second, you could buy a huge 62-inch Ubermensch HD TV for your room. Okay. Or you could, just spend it over the summer partying and so on. Or you could save it for graduate tuition and so on. Because you can only do one of these things with those resources, you are constrained by scarcity to make a choice. You choose that end which you believe will bring you greatest satisfaction. So let's say you choose the cruise, which means then you incur a cost. You give something up. The cost you incur is not the $2,000. That's simply the price. The cost in economics is always the next best opportunity for the use of those resources. We call it in economics the opportunity cost. The opportunity cost of the cruise is the 62-inch or the expected satisfaction from the 62-inch high-definition TV. So, immediately we have the concepts of benefits and costs introduced into economics. The benefit is the satisfaction you expect from the action. The cost is the satisfaction that is foregone in undertaking that action. I want to introduce two other concepts, twin concepts. Ex ante means from before, looking at things from before the action, and ex post. Okay, the Latin terms, ex means from after the action. Ex ante, benefits are always greater than costs. Okay, you would never choose the third alternative above what you rank higher, or the fourth alternative, or the second alternative above what you rank higher. Every individual always chooses that end or goal or aim that he or she believes will bring them the highest possible satisfaction. So, benefits, B, is greater than costs, ex ante. That's always the case. That's not where entrepreneurship comes in. Entrepreneurship comes in when the action has taken place and you either are satisfied with the action or regret the action. Let's say you go on the cruise and you cruise down to the Caribbean and you come within 100 miles of a hurricane. That's happened to me. It's not a lot of fun. Instead of being 6-foot waves, you get 30-foot waves and the boat rocks and stuff. So you hate that. You're not successful with the ladies on the cruise. The activities bore you and so on. Okay. So you regret this. Ex post, after the action, you can be in two situations, ex post. If you're satisfied with your action, the benefit's greater than the cost, you're happy that you gave up this alternative. However, you can make an error. In which case, you've given up something that had a greater value, the HD TV, for something that had a lesser value. You can't measure the difference between the benefit and the cost. Okay? So I introduce a third we introduce in economics a third set of concepts, psychic profit and psychic loss, which are prior to monetary profits and monetary loss. Psychic profit is a situation you find yourself in ex post when you're happy with your decision. Psychic loss is a situation you find yourself in ex post when you are unhappy or regret the decision. Okay? A good entrepreneur gains what? Psychic profit. Okay? The purpose of this example is to show that there's an entrepreneurial element in every action that you undertake. Not just in business, but in your daily lives. So, if this person regrets the cruise, has been a bad entrepreneur, his expectations of what was going to unfold in the future are not met, and therefore he regrets his decision. You've made an entrepreneurial decision to come here, to come to the Mises University. I mean, you could have spent the time, let's say the week, working. So if that's second, you've given up or renounced $400 that you could have earned from working over the course of the week for a landscaper or something, okay? Or you could have spent it on a camping trip with your friends, or you could have just spent it hanging out, watching your HGTV, okay? Now, so if you expected, though, that you would get the highest possible satisfaction from spending those scarce 7 days, which you can never get back, okay, these 7 days of your life, coming and observing these lectures. Now, you might be bored to tears by me. You might not like Hans Hoppe because of his abrasive personality. So don't tell him I said that, because ex post, that could be a big error for me. All right. So if that's the case, then you suffered an entrepreneurial loss. Okay? Hopefully you've all are good entrepreneurs in making this choice and you've profited. I'm hoping that you have. Okay, so to sum up this part, every action has an entrepreneurial element because of the fact that it is undertaken in the present and is aimed at a future point in time, which we can never know fully. We can never know the complex or the circumstances that will arise in the future. Okay, for sure. That's not to say, though, that everyone's on equal footing. It's all just guesswork. Some people are better entrepreneurs than other people. We'll come back to this. You might have friends that continuously make bad choices with their life. They're bad entrepreneurs. Okay? They might go to one college and not like it and go to a second college. I knew a guy who was, when I was in college, was on his third college. Okay? They may choose to go into, let's say, finance right at the top of the boom. And when they come out, there's no jobs available. Okay? That's my son. Actually, he did get a job finally, but anyway. So you get the idea. When you go to a restaurant, you know, people that always say, I wish I didn't get that. Okay? You get the idea. That's just bad entrepreneurship. Now, there are two different concepts of entrepreneurship that we want to go over because they're often confused in economics. One is a pure entrepreneur. And by the way, this sort of is debated on a high level among Wall Street economists. The pure entrepreneur is really an imaginary tool. He's not the entrepreneur that we think of that drives the market economy. Okay? The other is the promoter entrepreneur. We're going to spend most of our time talking about the promoter entrepreneur. But let me talk about the pure entrepreneur for a moment. Why do we have a pure entrepreneur? Why do we need this concept? We need the concept for the following reason. We want to explain why profit exists. Why is it that in the real world, land, labor, and capital, the landowner and the capitalist, the person who saves money and advances it in the process of production, why don't their incomes exhaust all the incomes in the economy? So in other words, we have a number of different functions. We have labor, we have land, and we have capital in the sense of money capital. We know return to labor is wages, return to land is rent, return to capital is interest. Capital involves the function of waiting, okay, for your income, of postponing your income, not consuming now, but lending that money or investing that money for greater income in the future. So it involves time preference, and there's a return to time preference to the fact that you're abstaining from consumption in the present, and that is interest. But where does profit come from? What does the entrepreneur actually do? Okay? And how do we distinguish between profit and interest? Because a firm gets its income as a combination of profit, interest, and also a return to the capital goods that it owns. But it's usually a very complex income return to the firm. So what we want to do with a pure entrepreneur is try to disentangle the different types of income that is that the firm receives. So what we do is we assume a world that is completely fictional. We call it the evenly rotating economy. It's sometimes called long-run equilibrium. Mises used the word evenly rotating economy and so did Rothbard because it's more descriptive of what we're actually talking about. So in the evenly rotating economy, what we do is we assume that there's never any more change in the world, that everything is adjusted. All goods that are being produced are the goods that the consumers demand most urgently, and they're being produced at their lowest possible prices. And from that point onward, we freeze all the economic data. So that means that tastes never change again, consumer tastes and preferences. Resources, available resources never change anymore. If one person retires from the labor force, there's someone with the exact same skills who is just entering the labor force. Okay. Labor force never changes size. It never changes its makeup in terms of skills. People can retire and die, but there will always be new people to take their place. We never run out of oil. If one oil well runs dry, a new one is just discovered of the exact same capacity. Okay? So the world doesn't change. People don't change their tastes. So supply and demand in all markets are what? Exactly as they were the day before. So that means that everyone knows what prices will be in the future. So in that world, if all capitalist investors know exactly what prices will be in the future, then what will happen to the prices of the inputs, of the land and labor? Well, I can illustrate this by holding up this $20 bill. Okay, you know that at the end of the day, I'm going to give you this $20 bill. Okay, ignore the fact that my name ends in a vowel and I come from New Jersey. So you trust me completely. Okay, so I have this $20 bill, and I auction it off to this room. What will be the price of this $20 bill? What will it tend to? $20. So that if a product costs in this world, let's say an iPod, an iTouch product costs $200, the price is $200, or rather, if it costs $200, the price will tend to be $200. If all entrepreneurs know that the price of this product is going to be $200, 1 year in the future, then they're going to bid, it takes a year to produce this good, then they're going to bid the price of land and labor and capital goods up to $200, okay, minus the interest rate for waiting 1 year. So if the interest rate is 5%, then the price that then labor and land that goes into that iTouch will get, let's say it's 10% to make it easy calculation, will get $180. The leftover $20 will be the interest return, approximately $20. Is there any profit in that world? There's no profit. So now we know where profit comes from. Where does profit come from? Profit comes from uncertainty. The fact that people are always changing their tastes and preferences. The fact that there are available resources that are always changing. There are new discoveries of oil wells being made. There are new people coming into the labor force or people that are in the labor force changing their skills radically. So the scarcities of labor, the scarcities of different natural resources are changing. Okay? Oh, and technology, of course. We assumed in the ERA technology was frozen. So this is a completely fictional world. It's called an imaginary construct. And we only do it to isolate profit. Now, these are not real people. Okay? These are just pure functions. The labor function earns wages, the land function earns rent, the capitalist function earns interest, and the entrepreneurial function earns profit. These are not real people. Most people in the real world, if you work, you're a laborer. If you put money, any money in a bank or in any other sort of financial institution or directly in a business, you're a capitalist. Okay? If you run a business on your own with your own money, you're a capitalist entrepreneur. So the pure capitalist doesn't exist in reality. It's just we isolate the capitalist function to explain where profit comes from, okay, using an imaginary construct. Okay, what I want to get to, though, is the other entrepreneur, the promoter entrepreneur. But we have an important truth, and that is entrepreneurship comes from the world of uncertainty and change. People are not certain of what the prices of different goods are going to be in the future. They're not even certain of what goods consumers will demand or if there'll be new goods that will come into existence in the future. That is the source of profit. So now let's go to the promoter entrepreneur. Now, one economist, Israel Kirzner, an Austrian economist, believes that the pure entrepreneur is the best way to analyze entrepreneurship in the real world, that you can actually, whether or not he believes you can actually do it, there are, you want to analyze the entrepreneurs having absolutely no resources. But in the real world, we know that anyone who's a major entrepreneur is a capitalist entrepreneur. Murray Rothbard uses the word capitalist entrepreneur, whereas Mises uses the word promoter entrepreneur to indicate that he promotes new and different technologies and products and organizations. So let's say some things about this real flesh and blood entrepreneur. Not an imaginary construct, but a real entrepreneur. Now, there are, look, everyone is an entrepreneur in the sense that if you go into, if you choose a certain major in college, you've allocated, you're a labor entrepreneur, right? Because you've allocated your labor to a certain, or you're training yourself to go into a certain area, which you could be wrong about, okay? So if you went into finance a few years ago, and there are very few jobs now, then that was an error, okay? And there are landowner entrepreneurs and so on. But the entrepreneur that really drives the market economy is the capitalist entrepreneur, the person who saves or has access to a large sum of capital and uses that to invest in new products or new technologies and so on, okay? And takes the risk of losing the money. Labor entrepreneurs and land entrepreneurs can make mistakes ex post. They can wish that they didn't go into finance, and that they went to, let's say, they majored in teaching or something else. But in that case, they don't risk any capital. They don't lose any capital. Okay? They just earn a lower income than they would have in the future. But a capitalist entrepreneur can actually earn a what? A loss. Okay? A loss. So that's why we focus on the capitalist entrepreneur as the most important. Okay. Now, the promoter entrepreneur is based on a basic datum of human action. And that is, which I mentioned before, not everyone is equal in forecasting and adjusting his or her actions to the changes that come in the future. Okay? Not everyone is good with dealing with uncertainty. Some people are better than others, and some people, Sam Walton, Bill Gates, are much better than other people. It's that class of people who form the capitalist, or who become capitalist entrepreneurs. They're interested in earning money from change. They want to earn their incomes from finding resources that are undervalued and can be moved to another area, these same resources, and combined into a new and or better product that has a higher value. So the sole source of their income is not labor, it's not land, okay? I mean, they may add labor, but that's a separate function. It's simply the difference in the value of the way the resources are being used in one case and the way that they can be used or imagined to be used in a new combination. Okay. So most of us do not have the qualities necessary to be a promoter or a capitalist entrepreneur. So what are the functions of the capitalist entrepreneur? First of all, the main function is really an intellectual function. It's to organize and direct the factors of production, land, labor, and capital goods. There's a difference between capital, which is simply the monetary investment, and capital goods, the physical capital goods that result from the production process. So the factors of production, when I use that term, refer to, as I said, land, labor, and capital goods. So he organizes and directs these factors of production, which means that he is the ultimate decision maker in production. Most of your textbooks will tell you or some of your textbooks that might discuss the entrepreneur, that the entrepreneur decides what to produce, how much to produce, where to produce, and how, what, where, how much.
When too,
obviously. Yeah. Okay. So that all comes under ultimate decision making, right? But in order to make a decision about production, since all production takes time, he must forecast the future. So he must be someone who is very adept at forecasting the future, and not just forecasting the future, okay, but actually appraising or coming up with prices that will exist in the future, a year from now, 2 years from now, or 5 years from now, depending on how long his production process is. So that means that he has to have good insight into people, individuals and people in general. That is, he must have an idea of how people's tastes will evolve over time. So, Steven Jobs, who was the founder of Apple in his garage, so the story goes, saw something, knew something about people that the entrepreneurs at IBM did not know. I mentioned this in a lecture already, but it was, I think, Bob Watson, who was the president of IBM in 1980, who said that no one would use personal computers in business. It would only be used as sort of a toy to play games and for household accounting. Okay. And so IBM did not jump into initiate the personal computer market. Apple did. Okay. And then you had Compaq and these other companies jumping in. Okay. Well, Steven Jobs saw things much differently than others, including other entrepreneurs. And as a result, he profited from that. He saw how business would change its usages over time. Okay. It didn't happen right away, but by the 1990s, personal computers were all over the place, and mainframes, which cost $3 million and had to be stored in a room that was this big, and have less memory, by the way, than just a regular small laptop today, and is not as fast. They were selling by the end. They were selling for $2 million. Okay, so they were losing $1 million per unit. Those investment decisions, however, were made in the early 1980s. Okay, to keep producing these mainframes, and now they're still useful, but you know, they're still used in certain areas, but the market has shrunk tremendously. Okay. What else must the entrepreneurs do? The entrepreneur must also own capital, okay? Risk his own capital. Must have capital in order to get access to more capital. And so that, therefore, he's a risk taker. And as a risk taker, he becomes the sole risk taker in production. Well, people might respond, yeah, but if a certain production process is incorrect, and is losing money, workers lose their jobs. That's not the point. The point is that when AIG lost $62 billion just in the fourth quarter of last year, did the workers get paid every 2 weeks or every month? Every worker got paid. Every worker got paid. Okay? Who was left holding the bag? The capitalists. Same thing with GM. GM lost over $10 billion last year. I think it was $32 billion last year. The assembly line workers all got paid. The other factors of production all got paid. Who took the loss? The entrepreneur, okay? That is the shareholders, the capitalist entrepreneurs, including the top management that own large positions or amounts of stock in the company, okay? So we say that not only is the sole risk taker in production, but he's also the residual claimant. He gets what's left over. He has the claim to whatever's left over after all costs have been paid and all revenues have been received. If revenues are greater than costs, then that is a profit. If costs are greater than revenues, then that's a monetary loss. So those are the characteristics of the promoter entrepreneur. Those are the functions in the real world that he must perform. Now let me talk a little bit about the ownership function versus the management function. The entrepreneurs determine the general plan for the employment of the factors of production. But they can't be everywhere, especially with big firms. Okay, they can't try to economize everywhere. They can't keep on top of all costs and so on. So they hire what Mises is called subordinate on, they have these subordinate entrepreneurial duties, okay? And those are making sure the plan runs smoothly, making sure the workers don't shirk, making sure that various shipments arrive on time of inputs, and that outputs go out on time. Those are all duties assigned to the managers. The managers are what Mises calls the junior partners of the entrepreneurs, okay? And they even will get paid a portion of the profits in the form of bonuses, okay? The more profitable their department or division is, the higher their bonus will be. So they do share in the profits as junior partners. However, what differentiates them from the entrepreneur is that their income can never be negative. They can maybe not earn profits, but they still earn some their basic income. Okay? So they don't lose capital. That's why they are not the ultimate decision makers. And Murray Rothbard, I heard in a lecture a number of years ago, give a very good example. Let's say that one of the Rockefellers, a very rich family, works in New York, bank, and then on weekends goes to the country estate in upstate New York, and he hires a head landscaper. And the landscaper, if you were to observe the estate, you see the landscaper making all the decisions about where everything is placed, what sorts of shrubbery and vegetation and so on grows on the estate, and where it is and the shape of it and so on. Okay? Now, someone might be tempted to say, well, he's the landscaping entrepreneur or something. But that's not true, because one day Rockefeller might come up to the estate, look around and say, this is crap. You're fired. Okay? He's the ultimate decision maker. Even if he doesn't make the day-to-day decisions, the owner is the ultimate decision maker. Okay? No matter how much he may delegate in various areas, he's the one that controls the general structure of the firm and of production. In fact, I've argued in a paper that I wrote called The Entrepreneur Real and Imagined, where I contrasted the pure entrepreneur to the promoter entrepreneur, that the firm is really the projection of the entrepreneur's personality into reality, into the objective world. Okay. Now we come to the question of who controls the corporate firm? There used to be a huge debate in the 1960s and 70s. And actually it started in the 1930s with two of Roosevelt's brain trusters, Burley and Means, one lawyer, one economist. And then this was picked up by John Kenneth Galbraith, who Murray once said about another economist, he knows even less economics than Galbraith. Okay, so Galbraith is sort of an institutionalist, doesn't believe in economic theory. So Galbraith said that in the modern industrial world, the firm is not run by the entrepreneurs, by the owners. The firm is run by what he called the technocracy. It was the clique of managers and engineers, scientific personnel that ran the firm, and they ensured that there was a certain level of profit. But their main goal was not to earn profit for the shareholders, the owners, but to grow the firm. So that because the larger the firm grew, the more responsibility they had, the more employees they had, therefore the higher their own salaries were, the more perquisites and privileges that they got, and so on. Okay. Well, there's a number of economic arguments against this, which I'll just point out very quickly. First of all, the board of directors oversees the so-called technocracy, if you want to call it that, and the board of directors can throw out the managers. Okay, if they're not, the board of directors supposedly, I mean, there's an agency problem, but the board of directors supposedly represent the shareholders, okay? There's also proxy fights. A large shareholder in a firm, and firms that have large shareholders or a large concentration of big shareholders, tend to be better run in terms of profit making. They can enter into a proxy fight in which they get the votes of the small shareholders, and they can vote the managers out. Okay, if they don't own 51% of the firm, they then lobby the smaller shareholders to give them their votes, and they'll throw the management out. But of course, most importantly, there are capital and money markets that control it might be called a market for managerial control. Okay, small shareholders do have an effect on the direction of the firm. If they don't like the profits they're earning, the dividends they're earning, the direction of the firm, they can simply sell their shares, which will reduce the value of the firm. So if the value of the firm falls from, let's say, $4 billion to $3 billion, that firm may be a good target for a hostile takeover. We had a lot of these hostile takeovers and so on in the 1980s. And there are always letters to the Wall Street Journal and to the New York Times saying, we should run our firms more like Japan does. Because Japan isn't worried about short-run profits. In Japan, the managers have room to be able to plan for the future and for the long run. Who always signed these letters? The managers, CEOs and so on, of those firms that were takeover targets. So hostile takeovers are good. They're good for shareholders. Okay? Because someone can say, you know what, I'm going to offer the shareholders $3.5 billion, and I know that I can use these assets in such a way, get rid of the management, use the assets, recombine them in a new way, sell some of them, whatever, and come up with $4 billion. So I earn $500 million in profit. Okay. So you have that market for corporate control operating to make sure that even the corporate firm is operated in the interests of the stockholders. Now, the government has tried to sort of slow this process down. For example, a law was passed in the 1960s, and it was sponsored by a corrupt senator from New Jersey who was caught in an Arab scam, which was where he was taking money from these pseudo-Arab sheiks. They have him on tape. His name was Harrison Williams. Anyway, his name is on that bill, and that bill requires that beginning to buy up corporate stock or more than 10%, a firm that wants to take over another firm has to give 30 days or 60 days notice. Okay? So of course that gives management time to begin to reorganize things so that they can sort of win the fight against being taken over. So the freer this process is, the better. Okay. Alright, now let me just talk about entrepreneurial profit. What it means, what its implications are, and what the entrepreneur is and is not. Okay. What economists mean by profit is different from what accountants mean. Let's take a very simple example. Let's say you have a landscaper who owns his own business, uses his own savings to start his business, and manages it. So let's say this is his profit. We use pi in economics to represent profit because P usually represents a price. That's equal to the total revenue of the firm minus the total cost. The difference between the accounting notion of profit and the economic concept of profit comes in what is counted under total costs. So let's say total out-of-pocket costs for this firm, for this landscaper, is $100,000. And he realizes total revenues at the end of the year of $145,000. Okay, and forgetting about depreciation for the moment, the accountant would say that, well, earnings are $45,000. Net earnings, they might call it. And therefore, the firm is earning a profit. But the economist would not concede this unless he knew more about the firm. So let's say we do know more about this firm. We know, in fact, that the individual owner also manages the firm. Well, you have to account for his labor, his managerial labor. And because there's an opportunity cost. He could work for someone else managing a small firm. And let's say the going rate for his services would be $50,000 per year. So you have to account for what we call implicit costs. And those implicit costs consist of, this is $50,000, foregone wages and so on. Let's say he also contributes what was his own savings. He invested $100,000. And let's say that in another world, not the world we have now where you can only get like 1 or 2% on a certificate of deposit, he could have put this $100,000 into a very safe certificate of deposit that's insured by the bank and earned 10%, just for simplicity. Well, then there's foregone interest that he's given up, okay, of $10,000. Finally, he has a dump truck of a certain size that he could have leased out for $5,000 to another firm. So we have foregone rent. Okay, so this is all foregone. So wages, interest, and rent. And that, those implicit costs total $65,000. So the economists would insist that you include that with the out-of-pocket costs, because these are the resources that are being used, in addition to the $100,000 of resources that are being imported into the firm. And now you find that this guy has actually suffered a loss of $20,000. Now, does this make sense? It certainly does. Because if, in fact, this is a situation, then it would pay this guy to shut the firm down and keep his $100,000 in the bank, go to work for someone else for $50,000, rent his truck out for $5,000. At the end of the year, he would have $65,000 plus his principal safe in the certificate of deposit of $100,000. So indeed, he did lose money if he only earned $145,000. So his break-even point would be $165,000, according to the economist. Okay, well, that's what profit is. What are its implications? What's the source and the function of profit? First of all, what is the ultimate source of entrepreneurial profit? It's uncertainty of the future. If everyone knew exactly what each item of output would be worth in the future, then you would have a situation where in every single industry, total revenue was equal to total cost, which would mean that everybody was just simply earning the going rate of interest. There would be no pure profit. So ultimately, it's uncertainty of future supply and demand conditions that bring about profit. Okay, but in the absence of this perfect foresight on the part of everybody, the better entrepreneurs will earn profits. And they do so by moving resources from lower valued uses to higher valued uses. Let's take a couple of examples. The great movie a few years ago, I don't know, over 10 years ago now, the Blair Witch project. Okay? Total cost was $60,000, the original producers. They used no-name actors. The last time I looked, total profit, or total revenue, was $5 million. Now, you have to add to that $60,000, $1 or $2 million that were invested in advertising it over the internet. Okay? But still, this was $50 million. There was a huge profit earned. Now, this certainly benefited the owners, okay, the investors in the film. However, it also benefited society because they took cameras, film, the time of the cinematographer and so on, and they combined these resources that would have been only worth $60,000 into a product that is worth the consumers $50 million. Okay? It's a huge gain, not only for the investors, but also for the consumers. Another movie that can illustrate this is that of the film Passion of the Christ that was made by Mel Gibson, okay? And everyone was, initially when he made the film, claimed that, you know, this film was going to be a bomb, that, no one's going to sit through this, reading these subtitles and so on. But in fact, I saw him on a talk show, and he quoted the figures. The film cost a total of approximately, let's see, $40 million to make. And worldwide, including its DVD distribution, it brought in total revenues of $500 million, or $500 million. That was the total revenue. So again, he used resources that would have been used by entrepreneurs to make lesser valued films, right? Recombined them into this vision of this very different film, and brought in $500 million in revenues, which represented a huge increase in satisfaction, though that's not measurable, to consumers. Okay, from the point of view of consumers, it was worth, in money terms, much more than any other than the alternative uses of those resources. Okay, and anyone's free to do this. Okay, that's where competition comes in. The Austrian would define competition as entrepreneurial rivalry. Everyone is bidding for these same resources. The best bids that the other entrepreneurs could come up with was $40 billion, because that's what they believed would be the value of the product of these things in the future. Mel Gibson had a different vision and turned it into $500 billion. Okay. So profits are a social represent or reveal the fact that there's been a maladjustment, that resources were used in a way that undervalued them. So profits always reveal a maladjustment. That's why the economy is never in an equilibrium. There's always something wrong in the economy. Now, not only that, that is that, that production as it currently is maladjusted or is not correctly adjusted to what consumers desire most. But the huge profit also indicates what? That the maladjustment is beginning to be cleared up, beginning to be fixed, corrected by the first entrepreneur into the business. So when the first, I'm old enough, unfortunately, I have to admit this, to remember this. The first hand calculator came on the market, I think it was Texas Instruments, it was $300, okay? Let's say the cost was $100. I don't know what the cost of production was. They made big profits on it. So we have price, this is minus average cost. And pretty quickly you had other people coming in, emulating them, and we had the hand calculators being produced, supply increasing. So it's a signal also to other entrepreneurs that there are maladjustments and that they're still existing and that you can still make profits there. Okay? It entails you forecasting that there's still these maladjustments, that people will still demand the product. And over time, you know, it fell to $100. In the early 70s is when it was $300. And, you know, it tended to wipe the profits out. Profits always tend to get wiped out. Okay? As what happens, actually, maybe let's say falls to $150. Two things happen. One, the product is increased in supply by rival entrepreneurs, but they're also bidding for the factors of production, and the factors of production rise in price to $150. So prices of profits always tend to get wiped out. Not only are they always reappearing because of the continual changes in data and technology and tastes, but they always tend to be wiped out. But what keeps them going? Well, in one case, things didn't stop here. People kept developing new technologies to make these hand calculators. So the first guy to do that, who might be able to lower the cost to $90, the average cost, all he has to do is lower his price to $140. Underbid his competition, earn huge profits, and then people will begin to emulate that technology. Well, this process continues until prices fall to very rock bottom levels. Today you can get the hand calculator that has the same functions as that first $300 hand calculator for $5 or $10. You get a scientific hand calculator, a financial hand calculator, which has much better quality than the first ones for, $80 or $90. Okay? But the profits tend to be wiped out. Let me give you one of my favorite examples of entrepreneurship here. How new products come into being and what they imply for consumers. This is an interesting article about a woman named Tomima, I don't know how to pronounce it, Edmark. She used to work in August of 1989, not a good time to be an IBM mainframe saleswoman, okay? And one morning she woke up and she looked in the mirror and she thought her long blonde ponytail looked a little drab. She looks good to me. Anyway, she found she could braid her ponytail by using a makeshift device consisting of a plastic loop, just a little plastic loop, and a knitting needle. Okay. It immediately struck her that other women who are working women, might want to have a quick way of braiding their hair, and so it struck her that maybe she should market these. So she was 32 years old then. She had $5,000 that she plunked down to get a patent. She called it Topsy Tail. I don't know if they still exist. And she went around different companies seeing if they would produce it, for her. She was turned down flat by a number of companies. Well, she bought her own mold for $9,000 in savings. She found a plastic maker who would produce as many Topsy Tails as she needed for about 50 cents a piece. Then she started advertising in small hairstyle magazines. Okay, so she ran her first ad, and that brought in $1,000. Okay, that was in 1991. By the end of 1991, she was moving 200 units a month at $10 each. So she's paying 50 cents, okay, maybe a little bit more with the advertising. So 50 cents, and she's selling the product for $10. Okay. So she was in New York on IBM Business. She persuaded the Glamour magazine editor to try Topsy Tail. The editor loved it and featured it in the February 1992 issue of Glamour magazine, which is a huge magazine with a huge readership. Within 3 weeks, Edmark had $100,000 worth of orders and had to enlist her cleaning lady to help stuff 400 envelopes each week. Then she got a big break. IBM fired her, eliminated her job, laid her off, along with 3/4 of her Dallas mainframe sales office. Okay. This is actually a great thing that they're not wasting these resources making these ridiculous mainframes. So she said it was really low off my mind. So she had $25,000 in early retirement package. She began to go to different retailers and hawk her product and hair salons and so on. She eventually, the sales dramatically increased, okay, but she figured that she had to go on television to really widely advertise this. And so she found a very small TV production company in New Jersey. They put together a 2-minute commercial, and she appeared in the commercial, it was advertised for, okay. So anyway, the strategy worked on her own. Edmark sold about 250,000 Topsy Tails at $10 a piece in 20 months. Okay. So she was already had sold then, had revenues then of $2.5 million in the first 20 months. Now, after the commercial ran, the first 6 months after it ran, she sold $3.6 million at $15. It's a multi-millionaire's, okay? Not only that, she reduced her cost to 22 cents. Cut it in half, okay? And she made huge profits. She never earned more than $80,000 a year at IBM, okay? So this is an example of taking things that would have been tremendously undervalued, knitting needle, and a plastic hoop, and then turning it into a product that is worth much more to consumers. Okay, this is the essence of entrepreneurship. Okay, of what the entrepreneur does in the real world, whether he's Sam Walton or Tamima Edmark. Okay, let me just tell you another quick story, and then I'll sum up. Ballpoint pens we all take for granted, but they, believe it or not, when they first were invented in 1946 or 45, they were luxury items. I mean, just like you leave a BMW in your driveway, you know, to show off the fact that you're wealthy, people would leave ballpoint pens on their coffee tables when they had people come over and so on. Okay, extremely expensive. And so it was initially developed by the Reynolds International Pen Company, which was capitalized at $26,000. Okay. Now there were two big rivals in New York City. Okay, if you saw the movie, 34th Street, the Christmas movie, Gimbel's and Macy's, and they would always compete. Okay, they're two big retail stores. In any case, this company then sold the pen to Gimbel's, and Gimbel sold it, began selling these ballpoint pens at $12.50 per unit, and it costs them 80 cents per pen. Now, that's $12.50 in 1946 dollars. That's over $100 today, okay, in today's dollar. Okay. By 1946, Reynolds had expanded the pen maker. They had a huge factory. Macy's now began to compete. Macy's introduced an imported ballpoint pen in 1998. In April, Eversharp, another company, introduced its first model of $15. So all these companies are beginning to get into the rivalry, okay? Prices are still very high. Reynolds, the first maker, then introduced a new model, kept the price at $12.50, but lowered costs to 60 cents. They use a new technology. The ballpoint pen company of Hollywood then got into the act, introduced the ballpoint pen for the first time below $10, $9.95. The response was that Reynolds then priced the pen at $3.85 but cut the cost to 30 cents. By December 1946, that's just a little more than a year later, there were approximately 100 manufacturers producing ballpoint pens and selling them now for $2.98. Okay? So you had 100 companies now starting up within 1 year's time. By February 1947, Gimbel's was selling a ballpoint a pen manufactured by the initial company. It was priced at 98 cents. Reynolds introduced a new model that was priced to sell at $1.69, but Gimbel sold the model for 88 cents. By mid-1948, ballpoint pens were selling for as little as 39 cents and costing about 10 cents per pen. Okay, same thing, same story for personal computers, hand calculators. Prices always tend to fall because new technology, once a product's introduced, new technology is another way of competing. It's not just introducing new products, it's introducing better and cheaper technology. Yes? I didn't read it, but there were a number of patent suits here. But a patent will, it's a monopoly, it will slow it down, but if it's defined narrowly enough, you can simply change it a little bit, okay? Of course we should get rid of patents. I mean, Tomima Edmark with that topsy-tail thing did make some of the profits were due to a patent that she got on it. Though people were competing, making it slightly different and so on. Okay, let me just sum up here. With a litany of what profit is and what it is, what entrepreneurship is and profit is and what it is not. Let me see if I can find this. I got 5 minutes. Okay. First of all, profit is not a return to a factor of production. When mainstream micro texts or managerial economics texts talk about profit at all, they say, well, it's a return to the factor of production of entrepreneurship. That's not true. Okay. The reason why it's not true is because entrepreneurship is not a factor of production. Profit can be negative. Wages can never be negative. Interest can never be negative. Okay? Though if it was up to Bernanke, he would try to make it negative in some way. And rent can never be negative. So profit has to be something else. It's sui generis in Latin. It's something of its own. And what is it? It's a return to a purely intellectual decision of how to use the factors of production. Entrepreneurship is not a factor of production, but it's a decision-making function of how to use them in a way that best serves consumers. Okay? Profits are never normal. Okay? They're due to what? A maladjustment. Profits indicate that things are being produced using inputs that have a higher value elsewhere. So they're never normal. The economy is never in a state of equilibrium. Okay? As long as their profits being earned. And there always will be under uncertainty. Okay? Not only are they not normal, but it does indicate that the abnormalities, the maladjustments are beginning to be corrected. Okay. Profits are not due to restriction of output. In all the examples I gave, there was no restriction of output. There was an expansion of output. Right? It's simply a movement or a transformation of resources from lower value to higher valued uses. A transfer of resources from lower value to higher valued uses. It's not all due necessarily to inventions. The guy who invented the Superman character sold that character for $500 in the mid-1930s. Okay? And that character has generated hundreds of millions of dollars in comic books and movies and so on. Right? So it's not the invention itself. The entrepreneur is the person, he may be the inventor, but he's the person that uses that invention in a way that appeals to consumers. Okay? You can introduce inventions too soon. Safety glass in automobiles was introduced by Ford in 1934. It added hundreds of dollars to the price of the car, but it prevented people from getting horribly disfigured in accidents. People wouldn't buy the car. Their income wasn't high enough to justify that spending on the extra safety feature. Okay? So Ford lost money on that decision. Let me just give you one last sort of an example, a fictional example, just because I want to hammer home this point of maladjustment. Let's say you have a region, and let's say it's isolated and very poor. Let's say it's Appalachia, let's say in Kentucky and West Virginia, and these people don't seek medical services very frequently, but there are a number of clinics that are, you know, on a periphery of the area, let's say Clinic A, Clinic B, Clinic C, and Clinic D. And these people occasionally frequent these clinics. And one day the guy in Clinic B sees what he believes to be the beginning of a pandemic, okay, an outbreak of some disease that's going to require a lot of medical services in this area. So he rushes in, hires more doctors, rushes in more medical personnel, sets up here, and he's right. And for the first month, he earns tremendous amounts of revenue. And people say, he's exploiting this increase in demand. He's exploiting this greater need for medical services. But of course, precisely the opposite, right? Had A, C, and D seen the same thing, what would happen to the price of medical services? They would have all rushed in, and supply would have been greater in relation to demand, and prices would have been lower. Okay? So, it's B is not the exploiter. It's quite the opposite. He's the one who begins to correct the maladjustment. Then he signals with the high profits that there is a maladjustment, and the laggards then come in. Okay? And supply is completely adjusted to demand, and profits are wiped out or whatever. Okay? But, so it's always wrong to blame the high profit firm, because the high profit firm, apart from patents and other types of monopoly, is the firm that is the first to foresee and adjust production to an area where there is a big gap. Okay? And I'll stop there.